Pero ¿a dónde andabas, Hilda? Cuéntame tu vida, que yo te andaba buscando. Hilda me contestó, Glenford, yo andaba con Rodán, es temerario. Sin salida, Pablo y Rebeca, Sansón y Dalila, los tres moqueteros, Catalina la Grande, Ricardo Corazón de León, fijaron una cita en la frontera. Conquistar el universo. El general murió al amanecer, la historia se escribe de noche. Siempre te dije te quise, en la cumbre de pasión. Como te quise, te quiero, estás en mi corazón. Llegó Superman bailando rock and roll. Oye, bailando el rock and roll, bailando el guaguancó.
Llegó Superman bailando guaguancó.
Bailando guaguancó, bailando yo, yo, yo.
Llegó Superman bailando guaguancó.
Bailando guaguancó, bailando guaguancó.
Llegó Superman.
Symposium 3, take 2. I tried to speak from the Havana of the mind and found myself an impossible refugee in the anachronistic wastelands of Passaic, New Jersey, a place in a book where I have not been physically either. But that is precisely the matter, because despite all of one's efforts, it seems that one always writes this from where one is not, a place in the almost, more than maybe. At a distance, a glass thick from the here and definitely one duration in anticipation of the now. For convenience, let's pretend this is proper English. And yet, later on I might need to say what time it is in our program. By the way, did I forget to say good evening, dear listeners? Tonight's epigraph is an anonymous poem sung by Eugenio Arango, the unforgettable Totico, drumming from one of the Havanas of the mind, in this case, the Bronx. A Havana no less real or unreal than the one depicted by Kalatozov in his I Am Cuba. You are right now hearing its background noise thanks to our kind friends at Milestone Films. But let's get back to Totico's recording with Patato Valdés in 1968. The song En el Callejón recounts an allegorical dialogue between the singer and the famous film character. Where were you going about, Gilda? He starts, and Gilda replies, Hey, Glenn Ford, I was roaming with Flash Gordon in the dead-end street. Pablo and Rebecca, Samson and Delilah, the Three Musketeers, Catherine the Great, Richard the Lionheart, they all set up a meeting at the border to conquer the universe. The general died at sunrise. History is written at night. A love stanza follows, and then the mysterious refrain. Superman just arrived, dancing rock and roll. Oh yes, Superman arrived, dancing guaguancó, dancing cha-cha-cha. A list of other Afro-Cuban dances follows the rhythm. This song is arguably a crystal of cultural and political references and experiences, an irresistible example of playful critique pursued through danceable music made by Cuban migrants in the Bronx. It accounts for the presence of extremely synthetic, germinal elements of a comparative thinking at work in popular cultures. And I am not emphasizing enough the S of cultures, especially those diasporic. Note that the poem contains only two markers of location, the dead-end street or blind alley and the border.
Por tu amor.
I will now introduce tonight's lecture, delivered by none other than Frederick Jameson, one of our living master thinkers, as an opening address to the symposium held in Bergen, Norway, to celebrate no other work than his own on the occasion of the 2008 Holberg International Memorial Prize. I want to thank the Secretariat of the Holberg Prize for allowing us to share this valuable recording tonight. It is a brief, irregular, I would even say rocky, sometimes even erratic presentation, remarkably titled, "Does World Literature Have a Foreign Office?" I am truly moved by the presence of Professor Jameson here tonight, in radio illusionistic proximity. He's even closer than the music, a hologram in a recording room. Even if his books are of that kind that one reads and rereads with the growing suspicion that only a sordid misunderstanding could have gotten us so interested in conceptual problems such as the nature of modernism at its twilight, the necessity for us to periodize or not, and as you will hear, the internal quarrels of some university departments in the dead end and across the border. But however crooked our path was to this critical wasteland, we don't know the way back.
So, ladies and gentlemen, now we would like to open this symposium and please join us in welcoming this year's Holberg Laureate, Professor Frederick Jameson.
Thanks so much, Sarah and Xiaobing. I'm, of course, enormously grateful for this distinction, and I am also very pleased that so many friends and colleagues have been able to come to it. I think maybe the best way one can respond to these honors is perhaps to try to push on into new intellectual areas, and I would like to do that, try to do that a little this morning in what I have to say. In fact, this brief intervention, I don't know if I have to hold this, do I?
No.
Do not.
This
brief intervention was suggested by my perplexity in the face of an interview question. These were the original interviews that I did with people from the committee in Toronto last fall. In the face of an interview question which asked me about the significance of international prizes such as this one. So, I want now to say what I think that significance is, but I'm going to divide my answer into two parts. I'll answer the general version of the question now and reserve a remark about this Holberg International Memorial Prize in particular for tomorrow. And the title of this is something like, Does World Literature Have a Foreign Office? In a general way, today, the International Prize forces us to raise again the question of nations and the relationship of national literatures to each other. And I'll include the recipients of this Holberg Prize under literature following Goethe's idea that what he called world literature, I'll come back to that, was essentially a network or relationship of different national critics and thinkers among each other, above and beyond the translation of purely literary texts. But does the nation state still exist under globalization? And what can be the status of so-called world literature in that new global system? Would it be governed by something like a literary United Nations? So I want to say something about the nation today, and then about literary value, and finally about relationship as such, which, according to me, has to be grasped in terms of otherness and negativity. The national is preeminently the place of the dialectical union of opposites, the space where the opposites coincide. The national is thus, on the one hand, the space of the most abominable ethnic cleansing, of bigotry and xenophobia in their narrowest and most provincial forms. Everyone will think of their contemporary examples to the point at which it seems almost obscene to undertake a celebration of nationalism in any form whatsoever today. Yet the national is also the figure for collectivity as such, whether we're talking about language, tribal or ethnic solidarity, or any other form of group or communal spirit. Indeed, class itself, the one collective category which seems to achieve universality independently of any of those categories, has most often, in all modern revolutions without exception, also been expressed in nationalist terms, or perhaps we might say that class solidarity has co-opted and appropriated the nationalist impulses. At any rate, it's worth affirming over against the various national, it's worth affirming as over against the various individualist ideologies that the very form of the group and the collective is always worth celebrating, is always positive, and this certainly holds for the great nationalist movements. Although perhaps we need to add Deleuze's proviso that the group or the national is always to be supported until it comes to power, until it achieves its nationalist ends, at which point it tends to swing back into its opposite, the tyranny of the majoritarian group, not so much over individuals as over the new minoritarian ones. I need to complete this picture of the dialectical ambivalence of the national with three observations. First, the nation still very much persists within globalization and is an essential component of it. And this for one simple reason, which is that it serves as the alibi for corporate oppression. The businessmen must be able to say, in order for England or Germany or the United States to remain competitive on the world market, workers must accept a cut in salary, a diminution of the social benefits, the now infamous give back. The nation thus serves as the ironclad argument for the neoliberal dismantling of the welfare state. Second, we must not only understand the national in terms of jingoism and collective conceit, it is in fact far more the place of the national wound, of the national misère, of the most intense forms of the national inferiority complex, and thereby of ressentiment and humiliation. The smaller and more economically and globally marginal the country, the more intense is this unique taste of the national in its citizens' mouths, the more sour the limits of their collective identity feelings. This is what explains the formal necessity of national allegory. Whatever the existential contents of the individual story or experience, it will always carry with it the overtones of this national subalternity. It will always be allegorical of the national misery. But as one approaches the center and the superstate, the more easy is it for its citizens to know the blindness of the center, to think of themselves as in uniquely private terms, to forget the national relations, the foreign relations, which also define them, but which now, as we might put it, define them unconsciously and can be repressed and forgotten, a relief not possible in other parts of the world. There is then very much a national level to our existential experience, however apparent it may or may not be. But in my opinion, it's always a great mistake to try to theorize these matters I've been talking about in ideological terms of national identity or national culture. And as a third or final comment, I'll say that as a response to this vexed question of the terms national, nation, nationalism, and so forth, particularly in my use of them here as a synonyms for any kind of collectivity or group ethos, I will propose the more cumbersome but more precise formula of the national situation, an expression which very much includes these experiences of what I've called the national misery or national subalternity. Indeed, I think the notion of a national situation goes a long way towards rendering more coherent and more serviceable what Goethe called world literature. If you read his enigmatic statements closely, you see that they don't so much aim at characterizing the world fame of Lord Byron or the newly discovered universality of the Shakuntala or of Persian poetry, so much as the emergence of what we may call institutions of cultural communication, the Revue des Deux Mondes, the Edinburgh Review, Le Globe, and so on and so forth, vehicles through which a foreigner can approach the national situation of a given country, including its literary and intellectual situation. What are the debates going on in this specific national situation? What are the concepts available to its intellectuals to articulate that situation? What literary forms respond to its needs or emerge in solutions to its dilemmas and contradictions? This is why I've proposed elsewhere, you see, Sarah, I do refer to myself, why I've proposed elsewhere to replace the old two-term model of reader and text with a four-term one, especially in the context of international relations, but also in terms of history in the past. It's not a question of a reader of one country or period developing or inventing some immediate relationship to the text of another one, Goethe's reading of Lord Byron, say, or Pound's reading of the Provençal Troubadours. This is rather a fourfold relationship in which the reader of one national situation achieves such contact with the text of another by way of the mediation of a relationship between two national situations. The national situation of provincial Germany enters into contact with the national situation of an emergent imperial Britain, and it's only by way of that relationship that the individual of the former can hope for any ultimate contact with the texts which express the latter, obviously by way of revolt and scandal in the case of Lord Byron. It's no longer here a question of a classic or universal literature. This is a complex contact between histories and concrete historical situations. And if this idea seems to perpetuate the old teleological conceptuality of the more advanced or the less developed, I think it does so only to undermine that teleology as well. For what must finally here emerge is the radical singularity and concrete difference of each of those situations. None is more advanced along the teleological pathway to modernity. Each is marked as universally determined and specific, which is to say uniquely national. Now, I think, well, here, one of the problems that misleads us here is the philosophical problem of aesthetic value, in my opinion, a false problem. It masks, indeed, a far more thorny philosophical problem, a real one this time, which turns on the opposition between universal and particular. For when humanist critics raise the question of value, what they really have in mind is universal value, and it's out of the notion of universal value that an antiquated and unserviceable notion of world literature has always come. I think this emphasis on universal value is wrong and misguided. It's unproductive even within the Western canon, giving rise to all kinds of false problems and questions like the following. Is Faulkner greater than Halldor Laxness, or vice versa? Is either greater than Tolstoy? Which is more universal, I Promessi Sposi or Red Chamber Dream? I won't pursue these silly questions any further here, except to say that they follow the Querelle des Anciens des Modernes of the 17th century on into the discovery of history and difference, and that the question of value is itself a historical one, which arises only after the fact and does not involve classification according to a priori categories. Rather than a transcendental dimension in which works share the same, henceforth, universal values, I propose that we attempt to think of the enigmatic realm we call world literature as a space and site of struggle, of competition and opposition. The literary struggle can here, first of all, be grasped in terms of the struggle between big power languages and small power languages, and to be sure, in terms of the control of the institutions of translation and transmission, publishing companies, universities, even still occasionally the cultural press, which regulate that struggle. But the question of big powers and small powers obviously brings us back squarely to the problem of the nation. I want here to propose a model of the dialectical unity of opposites and insist on the way in which a text can be evaluated in positive and negative terms simultaneously. But I want first to pay homage to that book which I consider to have been a foundational work for a whole new comparative literature, assuming that we agree with Franco Moretti's observation that the question of world literature is the same as the question about comparative literature as such. For Pascal Casanova's La République Mondiale des Lettres, the World Republic of Letters, insists strongly on the antagonistic relationality between post-colonial and metropolitan literatures, and also on the mediatory role of a third player, namely Paris, as a kind of gold standard, if not universal bank, through which these antagonistic values are discounted and processed through a kind of currency exchange with each other. I regret I have no time to discuss this extraordinary and path-breaking work further here. I'm going to conclude by suggesting that some of the problems that arise when we see world literature not in terms of the value of a single great or classical text, but rather as a relationship between national productions, one that can be antagonistic or dissonant, fully as much as it can be harmonious and somehow positive, that can involve difference fully as much as identity. So I would like us to imagine the following hypothetical possibilities. First, imagine a work of art which emerges from a generally nativist context, which expresses the values of the national tradition and its uniqueness, its superiority over foreign and imported models, and which affirms the autonomy or the need for autonomy of the national culture and its rejection of imports as well as its contempt for alien artworks and foreign ways of life. This is then a work of art which wishes to be absolutely particularist and to affirm its radical difference from those of other countries and its superiority over them. A work of this kind then wishes to be the opposite of universal, except insofar as this particular nativism might affirm itself as the only truly human form of life and culture. And if this nativism coincides with the national state form already achieved or longed and struggled for, then the work in question will generally be considered to fall under the rubric of nationalism and to raise all the problems associated with that ideology. But you're then also asked to imagine that this particular work has found worldwide acclamation and admiration. The international public then adds it to its pantheon of world literature and endows it with a nimbus of the world classic and of universality. This paradoxical result might be achieved in several different ways. The international public can, for example, choose to ignore the nationalistic and particularistic spirit and meaning of the work on the grounds that its political bias is irrelevant to its aesthetic qualities. Or it can simply misunderstand the work and fail to recognize its ideological and contextual significance for the home public. Or it can indeed argue that it is precisely its wrong-headed nationalistic passion, its situation centeredness, its commitment to the concrete and to the blood and soil of the homeland, which makes for its force and its value as an example to the rest of the world. This would also be a misreading, since it substitutes for the unique national reference the allegedly universal value of the national in general, the homeland in general, the unique native tradition in general. So we have here a most peculiar situation indeed. What is positive in one context is negative in the other. What wishes passionately to be particular on one level suddenly proves to be universal on another. What was rabidly ethnocentric is now saluted as part of the heritage of all mankind. To sharpen the paradox a little, we might speak of the deeper humanism of genocide or the compassion of bigots and the progressive values of the most ignorant reactionaries. Now I want to reverse my first illustration and ask you to imagine a national literature in which, rather than singularity in the local or national, it is universality that's emphasized, perhaps in the name of classicism, or perhaps in that of some eternal humanism. A national aesthetic of this kind might well be projected in the name of some identification of the national character or vocation with human nature itself, or on the basis of an association of the national tradition with reason and clarity and the lack of specific national characteristics or idiosyncrasies in the first place. Yet we may also imagine that on the world stage, in a polyphony of distinct and colorful styles and artistic languages, this particular classicism might well be found to be abstract and insipid, without any great international appeal, and indeed in a paradoxical reversal, simply taken as the local expression of some incomprehensible collective taste for an unadorned purity of little interest to the rest of the world. Here, universality itself becomes just another particularity, while implicitly it's particularity which comes to see universal in some richly multicultural world bazaar. Indeed, we could make a case for modernism itself as staging such a paradoxical situation in which it is the local and the singular which becomes universal and which then discards the pretensions of some universal world aesthetic standard to the historical ashcans of the boring and the old-fashioned and the outmoded. Modernism would then be a uniquely dialectical phenomenon in which it is precisely the commitment to the private, the local, or even the idiosyncrasies of a specific national culture, which is now alone capable of acceding to the abstractions, the necessarily abstract realm of the universal, that very singularity in language or in imagery or content, which is closed to us as foreigners, then becomes the seal and sign of this universal value of all art, of such art, while the attempt to contribute to world literature as such, to fashion a world which in its universal experience and its expression of the eternally human is dismissed as a humanism utterly without interest and without the vocal power and resonance capable of carrying it across international borders. There is a suggestive political parallel here, which I take to be structural in nature, if not in content, and I have just a few more pages here. This is the disjunction between the realms of domestic and foreign policy, which are almost never homologous or isomorphic, but tend to stand in inverted ratio to each other. I think we're familiar in various places with the situation in which the domestic policy of a given administration could be judged progressive, while its foreign policy is quite the reverse and can be characterized as repressive. But the opposite is also true, and we've sometimes been able historically to observe a reactionary regime with a progressive foreign policy. I think this is because in personal identity as well as in the external world, these two dimensions, the subjective or existential one, and the objective relation with the other, collective relations as opposed to individual ones, today miss each other like different planes in infinite space, although one can certainly imagine worlds or historical moments in which this would not be necessarily be the case. So also, I believe, with the foreign policy of literature, so to speak, as opposed to its domestic one. The only way of thinking these two incommensurable realities together without collapsing one into the other is the dialectic, one of whose functions is precisely to conceptualize what is thus contradictory or non-thinkable. Works thus function simultaneously on at least two different levels, as it were, its foreign policy level and its domestic one. A work emits two messages simultaneously. It's at one and the same time about itself and about the world, an auto-referential designation and a new construction of language, the psyche, the situation as such. And in that Darwinian process, which, as Franco Moretti has shown us, is as fruitful a figurative reference for literature as the market, the work must wage a dual struggle as a formal mutation and must attempt to survive in its own internal habitat or ecosystem, and also affirm itself outside on the world scale against its competitors from other countries who are as hungry for recognition and species perpetuation as it is itself. But as we've shown, these two simultaneous struggles may involve quite different and sometimes incompatible strategies. The Althusserians used to talk not about proposing solutions, but about producing problems. I don't feel that I've done much more than that today. On the other hand, they also thought that to produce a problem was better than any of the solutions one might invent for it, and I'm reassured by that belief. Yet if I haven't solved anything here, these considerations have at least put me in a better position to try to answer the original question I found myself confronted with, namely the significance of international prizes of this kind. And I conclude in this way. The older system of prizes sought to establish universal values, a literary canon, for example, valid for the whole world, in such a way that the classics of the smaller language countries or the non-Western ones were afforded their rightful place among the more generally acknowledged big power Western masterpieces. Now, however, what any concept of world literature must include is the operation not only of radical difference and of opposition, but also of dialectical ambivalence, as well as of unevenness and canonical inequality, if I may put it that way. Therefore, the emergence of such awards from non-central countries and non-hegemonic locations, from Stockholm or Bergen, for example, rather than from Paris, London, or New York, has the effect of suddenly lighting up the international grid, of unexpectedly mapping literary globalization for us, of confronting us not with some universalizing solution, but rather with an ongoing problem, the problematic of the nature of global relationships and their structure and dynamics today. World literature is then not some already given pantheon or imaginary museum to which masterpieces are regularly added. It is another name for a problem and a conundrum. How can differences relate today? How can nationality be universal? How can global multiplicity be imagined without a center? Thank you.
After these 20-odd minutes, we are reminded of the lecture's title with estrangement. Does world literature have a foreign office? And well, it has taken us some time to realize that this captivating title is actually a bear trap. So in the following minutes, I will try to get my foot out of it without having to cut it off. It is, first of all, striking to hear Professor Jameson speaking in such figurative terms as foreign offices and United Nations of Literature. Nations. What nations? A global government for literature? What? Professor Jameson enters the sour discussion on nationalism jokingly, something one can understand since it's essentially a foul one. And what he says about nations seems, at least from my denationalized end or dead end, essentially right. It is no twilight of the nation state nor nationalism we are living in. Quite on the contrary, nation states will continue to be used, as Frederick Jameson points out himself, as alibis for a better and smoother corporate control. Think of all those aspiring nations, populations with a historical singularity that keep dreaming and dreaming of acquiring a state with a beautiful flag and lots of offices and institutions that will be essentially the same as anywhere else. Obviously, the difference between nationalistic and anti-nationalistic dreams is that the latter takes on prior conceptual work and, frankly, no one wants to dream difficult. From this side of things, again, it seems that identity is one of those problems that could not be satisfied by a single political solution, such as the creation of a new state. Rather, the only satisfaction for the nationalistic craving or lust seems to be perpetual war, at least on the symbolic plane. If, as Jameson explains, nationalism is in the global imperial framework an obscene lie, in the post-colonial framework it should be considered, Jameson continues, a disposable rhetorical tool for regional emancipation, quickly to be evacuated once its goal has been attained, the last exit. Jameson's characterization of the national situation carries echoes of the expression national reality, commonly used, at least in Romance languages, for contexts of nationalistic struggle. Jameson adds a passive or patient twist to it, implying that literature has to coexist with, rather than emerge from, a certain set of collective stage rules and narratives that are marked by the ideology of national identity. Now, how does this word national stay afloat in a world of mobility, migration, de- and re-territorialization, global branding and culture industries, data exchange, etc.? That question can solely be given the same reply all the questions about the ever-growing popularity of false consciousness are given. However, it seems difficult to believe Jameson's thesis about a relation of inverse proportionality between the size of the country and the intensity of the miserable nationalistic feelings. It looks like a hasty analogy, even a crude extrapolation. Should this mean that the most nationalistic countries in Europe, for instance, are Monaco, Luxembourg, and Switzerland? Let alone Andorra. Is Belize more nationalistic than, say, Argentina or Brazil? In sum, Jameson's idea about the inferiority complex as the central nationalistic feeling should apply instead to all nations or none. And I suggest let's just start with the big ones to promote the example. But enough with nations. If we accept the superstate or a transition stage between nation states and superstates with global post-nations as the only valid framework for world literature in the present, then we are somewhat forgetting that the influence of those structures, however transitional they may be, does not apply homogeneously to all singularities, and that the relations of citizens with the transnational superstate are certainly not isometric or equidistant. To that extent, again, it seems highly artificial to speak about world literature in the present time as an interplay of national identities and realities, as if we could quantify memory, influence, and degrees of displacement. Unless, of course, we want to wipe out some singularities and tuck them into the container of what Margaret Cohen called the great unread. Especially if we consider that those singularities will be more crucial than ever in revealing the nature of so-called world literature, a literature of disparate worlds. Just think about Pound, to use an example Professor Jameson invokes. Can you think of Israel Pound as an addition of national situation percentages? We seem to shift from one false problem to another. As for this part so far, and the remainder of the lecture, Professor Jameson has only moved away from the opening question, as a hunter walks away from the bear trap once it's set, or perhaps he has drawn a dense scrubland around it only to reach an oblique vantage point on the question. We have to assume that such an oblique vantage point is introduced by his definition of modernism as a quote-unquote uniquely dialectical phenomenon, allowing us to transcend the national particularities of a literary work and bring it to a field of readership that is itself defined by quote-unquote universal foreignness, the foreign office of modernism itself being, you guess right, postmodernism. But what foreign office is this that has franchise stores everywhere the ideology of modernism is represented, which is pretty much everywhere? Isn't this another false clue that inevitably brings us back to the previous set of dodgy problems, exemplified now by the hardly compelling quote-unquote dysfunction between the individual and collective dimensions that miss each other like different planes in infinite space? I ask myself, weren't we rather talking about the surface where the plane itself is drawn or imagined? But if there was an interesting question at the beginning, that was not the simultaneous operation of literary works on a domestic and an international level, thanks of course to the miracle of the dialectic. The interesting question was not either the significance of literary prices. The interesting question concerned the possibility of a foreign office for foreignness itself, a meta level for meta literature, whose mysterious location and dissemination may constitute an aesthetic locus itself, a mesosphere of critique the idea of foreign office made us dream of. One could devise another lecture, this time by the famous Canadian ex-senator and UFO conspirationist Paul Hellyer, in which the truth about extraterrestrial literature is finally revealed. Like, prose exists in other planets. Aliens have their own science fiction in the form of pastoral human novels. And they are all fans of the works of Dan Brown. Something like that. Yet, if we acknowledge the current dissolution of national identities, and regardless of nationalistic agendas being implemented in post-national cultural contexts, and if we accept the simultaneous dissolution of major cultural genres, again, regardless of the implementation of literary genre agendas in post-genre contexts, such as the novel, the feature film, the music record, etc., then the question of the foreign office takes almost redemptive undertones. The transformation of genres into liquid categories, into openness, of literary or artistic works in an infinitely viable blend of forms, aesthetic idioms, media, and layers of referentiality beyond the mere local. This hyper-dissolution and multiplication of works as digital files and not their reproduction as analog documents can only transform, dissolve, and multiply both the conceptual nature and bureaucratic infrastructure of such disciplines as comparative studies, art, critical or historical studies, and philosophical aesthetics, to name only the closest ones. Soon, the words book, album, film will melt, turning books, albums, and films into documents, historicizing media. Exactly as we are tending toward a world population, we are tending toward a single medium or web full of disparate hypertextuality. And this is not a strictly coincidental analogy, but it is not an accident either. Of course, in both planes, singularities will be constantly pushed toward the beneath. In other words, the dissolution of media will just reproduce a great unread based on its new forms, although there will still be a great deal of unread people and unread desire. We will live under the hegemony of mirroring and bifurcation, and everything will be readable, but not read. The great unread actually moves toward the center. Maybe Moretti's trees and formalist waves will work in real time soon, only to make Borges's vision of a world-size map of the world seem diminutive. There will be so much to read that, as Moretti the prophet has anticipated, no one will read. It's ironic to think about books growing back into trees, by the way. There will be lots of pills for headache, that's for sure. There will be glare. Far from simplification, the humanities will be divided in two branches: studies of studies of studies, or studies cube, and studies without subjects, emphasis on the S. Did I forget to say goodnight?